To be mature, said Ernest Campbell, is to build schools in which you will never study, to plant trees under which you will never sit, to grow churches in which you will never worship. John, the beloved disciple, the author of 1 John, John would agree. John Dempster would agree. John would agree. John Appleseed would agree. John would agree, John Wesley would agree, with regard to building schools and planting trees and growing churches. Following the calamitous, thunderous, munificent apocalypse of love that is Easter, strewn about the lawn of life, there are parcels and morsels of bits and pieces that we need to attend to. So today we have heard the reading of the Easter Gospel for this year a second time, Mark 16, 1 through 8. This portion of the Gospel ends with a preposition, the word for in Greek. It ends in mid-sentence, that is. They were sore afraid for dot, dot, dot. It is an unfinished gospel. When we gather for the Lord's Supper, come Easter and Eastertide, we are met by an unfinished grace. In the case of Mark 16, the gospel is literally, not a word I use often with regard to the Bible, in this case, literally unfinished. Oh, some who have commented, who are more critical moderates, have argued that there are two or three other places in antiquity where a document ends with a preposition in this way, but most, the moderate critics, if you will, see and sense that probably what happened here was that a portion of the codice, the ancient manuscript, was lost, as often happened at the beginning and the ending. So there is literally an unfinished grace that meets us. Should you question or doubt, which I hope you will, you might want to consider that the further use of Mark 16 invariably involved people trying to finish the unfinished, to end the unending ending, beginning with Mark, or whoever followed in Mark's name, him or herself. That is, that there are two alternative endings to Mark, one longer and one shorter. They're not necessarily improvements, except in a grammatical sense, but they are attempts to finish the unfinished. Likewise, 20 years later, Matthew and Luke came along and they gave their own ending to the unending ending. It's as if you were to buy a house, an older home, and you want to add a family room that hadn't been there. So you build on a family room and you try and fit the aesthetic and the age of the home. But those who visit know this is an addition, a nice addition. Matthew and Luke make such an addition. Likewise, the fourth gospel, the writer of which may have known a sketch of Mark 16, 1 through 8, adds to that portion of his Easter message a further story you remember about Mary, a further story you remember about the disciples, a further story you remember about Thomas. We are met come Easter in the Holy Communion before us with an unfinished grace. That is, friends, life is open, freedom is real. We are cautioned to have a little bit of humility about what we think we know. You may, for instance, be returning, I don't know, one or another, from a long series of days in meetings at a conference, say a general conference of the Methodist Church in Tampa. You may have been there 2 weeks and discovered that the meeting itself was an unmitigated disaster, and here you come home, and you may be a little bit tired and weary and wondering what the future holds. Mark this, come Easter. The future contains a grace that is alive, afoot, active, and unfinished. Unfinished grace, for one thing, meets us in encouragement come Easter. For another thing, this is another of these parcels and morsels from the lawn of life strewn about after the calamitous and thunderous tornado-like event of the apocalypse of love at Easter. We didn't hear from John chapter 19 this year, another year we will, but in a service midweek, I heard the reading of that passage just before the resurrection accounts. You remember it. It involves a person who doesn't appear in the other Gospels. He had been stage center in John chapter 3. He had visited Jesus at night. He is the quintessential professor, college professor, or other, and his name is Nicodemus. How, he asked, can I be born anew? Must I enter my mother's womb once more? And Jesus replied, the Spirit blows where it wills, and you hear the sound of it, but you do not know whence it comes or whither it goes. And so it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. There is Nicodemus, and then he disappears all the way, with one exception, to the very end of the gospel. And he reappears. The other Gospels have Jesus buried by Joseph of Arimathea alone. But here comes Nicodemus just at the very end. A little late, you might say. Perhaps too late, he thought, to respond finally in love to the one who loved him to death. And here he is, John 19:29, bringing along to the grave 100 pounds of myrrh and aloes, a pretty penny, my friend, away, though late, but it wasn't too late, though he didn't know that, to respond in love to the unfinished grace of the Easter gospel. So poignant, so human, so typical of who we are. We don't know what we've got till it's gone. We don't know what we had till it's lost. And then Nicodemus responds, and here he is, one of those points, parcels, morsels of the Easter accounts. You may be wondering what happened, say, at a meeting over the last couple of weeks. Maybe you realize now, as you've come home across the country, someone in Nebraska or Arizona may realize just what happened. Oh my goodness. For 200 years, in one way or another, in our denomination, the United Methodist Church, we have had a security of appointment, which was the basis for the covenant of clergy in the conference, which was the basis for the functioning of itinerancy and appointment and apportionment, and especially was the basis for the freedom, the protection of the freedom of the pulpit from episcopal overseers who might be made uncomfortable and respond accordingly by something said in the freedom of the gospel. And what? You notice? Without debate, without conversation in the full plenary, gone. It would be like, in a stroke, eliminating tenure on the Charles River campus without debate. And you come home and you see, oh, so that's what we had. Covenant, gone. Itinerancy, gone. Freedom, gone. You don't know what you've got till it's gone. True of friendship, relationship, true of the sense of a college experience. Sometimes you don't really realize what you had until that last 2 weeks. So poignant, so true. And here comes Nicodemus with his myrrh and aloe. And isn't there a bit of Nicodemus in each one of us, sensing that it's too late, but coming anyway? And in the gospel, the unfinished grace of Easter, it's not too late. It's not too late. Even all of these things that have so recently transpired. They can be modified by a judicial council. They can be modified and replaced by a future vote. There's more future in the future sometimes than the future you see. This unfinished grace in bread and cup meets us to encourage and also to caution us about what we think we know about what may transpire. These are the portions, the parts of Easter that linger with us here in this nave and in this community. There's another. On Easter and the six services from Thursday till Sunday, three on Easter morning, we had an explosion of body and spirit. We had 1,000 people in those six services. And the additional service on Easter at 9, for which the choir sang, was a portion of that. Following the last service and the joy of Easter, I happened to look up at a window. The window is the last one here on the west end, and it is devoted to Francis Willard. For those listening on the radio, I'm making my way down the center aisle of Marsh Chapel to greet in a more personal way the happy and friendly faces and people of our beloved congregation. I'm going to ask them, and you afar in the mind's eye, to turn and take a look at the one woman in the large windows here. She is just to my left and to the left of Abraham Lincoln. You know, when Daniel Marsh rebuilt the sanctuary, built this chapel 60 years ago, he solicited input about who should be in the final window. The other 7 came from the older chapel. He knew he wanted Lincoln, so he asked for advice, and guess what? He got some advice. Names and input from near and far. And finally, he selected, over time, a window devoted to Francis Willard, a former dean of women at Northwestern University, a pioneer, a feminist, a suffragette of the 19th century, one of the great forces behind temperance and prohibition in the 19th century. She died in 1898, 20-some years before women received the right to vote. She had been born near Rochester, New York, in the land known to Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And she was a powerful voice aiming through temperance to the voting rights that later came for women. My grandmother was born 30 years before women had the right to vote in this country. My mother was born 8 years after suffrage. Can you believe it? Here enshrined is Frances Willard, who said, "Temperance is moderation in things that are good and abstinence from things that are not." Well, we would agree with that. It seems, though, that in our setting and in our time, the presence, the awkward presence of Frances Willard in our nave reminds us, speaking of unfinished grace, that we have in our setting some unfinished work with regard to developing a culture across the country, a faith that is amenable to culture and a culture amenable to faith, particularly in the use, the social use, of beverage alcohol. We're not done. Her route turned out to be the wrong one. Prohibition, as Ken Burns has fully reminded us and well, didn't work, and we're not headed in that direction. But she reminds us by her presence that we still have work to do to find a way to shape a culture that, as she said, of temperance, is moderation in things that are good and abstinence from things that aren't. I'm going to linger with you here, Jay, just for a minute with Frances Willard, only to say this. There's another aspect of her story that I think you should know. See her standing there, bright and tall in her blue gown. She traveled the country many years, 30,000 miles a year and 400 speeches every year, accompanied by her longtime partner and companion, Anna Adams Gordon. She said, when challenged about her relationship with Gordon, "Let me tell you, there is not a village in this country that has no example of two hearts in council, both of which are feminine. She's telling us something, especially those of you who may, I don't know, have come back from a meeting in Tampa or elsewhere, that there is a day coming when 8 and 9 year old girls and boys in our Sunday schools around the globe who know that they're not in the majority in orientation will nonetheless feel and hear and know the full blessing of the ministry of the gospel, the unfinished grace. It's coming. For Frances Willard, it came 23 years after her death, suffrage. And some of us may not be living to witness the change, but it's coming. It's coming how? Like the glory of the morning on the wave. It is wisdom to the mighty. It is honor to the brave. And the world will be its footstool and the soul of wrong its slave. God's truth is marching on. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and one who loves is born of God and knows God. One who does not love does not know God, for God is love. In this is love, not that we loved God, but that God loved us and sent his Son to be the expiation for our sin. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God's love abides in us and is perfected in us. To be mature is to build schools in which you will not study, to plant seeds of trees under which you will never sit, to grow churches in which you will not worship. John would agree. John Dempster, John Appleseed, John Wesley. Amen.